Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Rocks Back Pages podcast. After a week dominated by Dominic's comings and goings, we are still in lockdown and keeping a safe distance from each other. I'm here as ever with Mark Pringle.
Hi, Bonnie.
And Jasper Morrison Bowie.
Hello, Bonnie.
And this week we welcome the great John Ingham into our virtual cupboard. Hi, John.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well. John has joined us to discuss his long and fascinating career. He will also be, I hope, talking to us a bit about John Peel and even possibly about Lady Gaga, though I'm not going to hold him to that. John, it's lovely to have you here. You've been on Rocks Back Pages for a good number of years, and you are in many ways one of the key music journalists. One of the things that fascinates me about you is that we have been able to showcase three pieces by you. The first of which is seeing Aretha Franklin at the Fillmore West in 1971. And the second is interviewing the Sex Pistols when they're only 4 months old. I don't think there are many music writers who could sort of have that essentially in their CV. How do you get from Aretha at the Fillmore to the Sex Pistols in Soho?
Even more interesting, how would I get from the Grateful Dead to Aretha to the Sex Pistols? Which is kind of how it all started in many ways. I was living in California.
How did you get to California? Why? Why California?
Okay. My mother had this incredible urge and dream to go and live in the United States, which, hard as it is to believe now, certainly in the 50s was probably the most amazing place on earth that you could live. Yeah. And she'd had this very long-held desire to get there. So she succeeded. She was a teacher. And we were living, I spent pretty much 13 to 21 in the West Coast of America, ending up in Los Angeles in 1969. And I was there to go to California Institute of the Arts, which is better known as CalArts. And there was a guy called Robert Christgau, who was the Village Voice music critic, who had been hired as a popular culture lecturer. So I took that class because it sounded interesting. And in the first week, he handed out a bunch of records to everybody in the class and said, I want you to write a review. And the next week after we handed them in, he said, you're the only guy in the class that has a hope of knowing how to write. If you'd like to, I'll teach you how to become a rock critic. So I said, yes, and off we went. And that kind of, he opened the door, he talked to the editors at Cream, and so I got to know them and started posting pieces there, and also, and then it grew. I did some stuff for Rolling Stone, for a Boston paper called Fusion, yeah. Some others. So I was writing, and the Aretha Franklin piece was for Cream.
So you were, I mean, really in at the dawn of, you know, American rock criticism. I mean, I remember the first time I opened an old copy of Cream and saw your name in there, and I just hadn't realized that you kind of went back that far and knew these guys. So you have a fascinating perspective, John, I would imagine, on the kind of evolution of what Rocks Back Pages is all about.
Yeah, I'd say so. My first published piece was December of 1970. Before then, I saw my first copy of Rolling Stone. I think it was issue number 9. I mean, you know, it had Grille Marcus in it. It had Nick Toshes was writing at that point. It had people who were really good. And that was exciting. The photography was the thing that really caught my attention. And that was all people like Jim Marshall and Baron Wallman. Mm-hmm. And somewhere along the line, I realized these guys were getting their records free. And since I spent all my money on records, so I thought, well, this is a good deal.
How many rock critics have you had come on this podcast and say exactly that? It's great.
Probably every one of them.
Yeah, exactly. What was the first piece, John?
Grand Funk Railroad at the Inglewood Forum. Well, they were a Detroit band, and Christgau really liked them. I mean, he saw them as a working class band.
He's kept quiet about that, I think, isn't he?
I don't think he's ever afraid to say what he likes.
Actually, you know, Barney, a lot of the Americans, surprisingly, I mean, Lenny Kaye liked Grand Funk. True. Our kind of total rejection of them as this kind of construct. You know, yeah, I think what John's saying is right, that a surprising number of very good American critics had quite a lot of time, certainly for the early iteration of Grand Funk Railroad.
And let's not forget Todd Rundgren produced their big hit album, you know, We're an American Band, which I think sums it up. Anyway, that was the first piece. And the funniest part of that was I went with Chris Gow, and he takes a paperback book to every concert he goes to, or did then. So he would, while you're waiting for the band, who are inevitably late, he'd be reading. And then in the middle of the gig, when it got boring, he just pulled his book out and started reading till it got interesting again.
So you were in California, both Northern California and Southern California. Obviously, you had to go to Northern California to see the Queen of Soul at the Fillmore West. Yep. So were you going sort of back and forth between the two cities?
Well, before L.A., I was living in Fresno, which is kind of midway between L.A. and San Francisco.
That's where your mother moved to, was Fresno.
Well, I mean, the long detail is we were in Vancouver in Canada, and then we moved to Eugene, Oregon, where she went to the U of O and picked up a master's. So in 1966, Eugene was kind of like San Francisco North, because Ken Kesey was from Eugene.
Indeed.
And so I saw a couple of bands who were can barely remember their names now, who came through, but there was a lot of that's how we knew about things like Big Brother and Grateful Dead and Country Joe very, very early on in Eugene, like middle 66. Mm-hmm. I would know about those bands.
So you knew about like the acid tests and things like that?
Yeah, absolutely. And the Oracle newspaper was being sold in Eugene. There was a head shop, this new idea. I remember very much someone came in to the school's drama class and he had the first Jefferson Airplane album. And this guy was the school folky. And he was really like going, you've got to hear this record. And someone turned around and said, is this what they mean by that word psychedelic? So my first ever concert, we went to San Francisco on Easter 67. My first real concert was going and seeing Big Brother at the Avalon.
Fantastic.
With my mother in tow, 15 years old.
What an extraordinary childhood. I mean, there really can't be many. Well, you were born here in the UK, I take it.
I was born in Sydney, Australia.
Hence, do you still have a tinge of Australian in your accent?
It'll come out sometimes, mate.
But you have had an extraordinary journey. I mean, it sounds like a kind of... It sounds like a kind of Hollywood movie, this going from Eugene, Oregon to Fresno to... Anyway, amazing. And your mum dropping you off at the Avalon Ballroom.
Oh, no, she came in.
Oh, she came in.
Oh, no, yeah, she came in. It was...
What a cool woman.
The funnier one was we went to... I was reading Ralph Gleason a lot because the Chronicle was in Fresno at the high school that I went to. And he was raving about B.B. King. And I thought, this sounds really interesting. And we were going to San Francisco. So she came to see B.B. King with me. And they gave her a chair. She was sitting in the middle of the dance floor, well, in front of it, because everyone was sitting down. And we were like, 20 feet from the stage? And she's sitting there 45, 50, something like that. 45, probably. Sat and watched B.B. King do his full review while I'm on the floor next to her with the Birds and the Electric Flag supporting.
Fantastic.
It
was amazing. I have to say, that's one of the best things I've ever seen. B.B. King in full flight with a 15-piece band behind him.
Amazing.
You know, powder blue suit and a red Lucille.
Wow.
How blue can you get?
I mean, your review of Aretha's famous show at the Fillmore is wonderfully kind of vivid. It really brings the event to life.
Thank you.
Do you still remember shows like that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a lot you forget, but there's a lot that really stick out of that period, definitely. Jefferson Airplane, who were my favorite band, really, over the period. and the Grateful Dead. I mean, people forget Grateful Dead was seriously a radical band. I mean, they were just like a freeform jazz band in many ways. And I liked that because they were just so weird. That I saw them three or four times at least when no one, you know, I mean, literally you could see like 100 people outside of San Francisco would go and see it. And Jefferson Airplane was really memorable, mainly because they are extraordinary musicians as individuals. What else do I remember? Those would be the high ones. I mean, Country Joe, I remember that. The Doors. I saw The Doors on the night I graduated from high school. which also memorably was the first time Jumping Jack Flash came booming out of a car radio.
Well, those are good memories. I remember talking to you in the past, John, about seeing, I think, the first time the Eagles played at the Troubadour in LA.
That's right.
So you were in LA in 72. Yeah. And I remember interviewing you about that time, and you were very funny about that Eagles show, as I recall.
The Eagles, yeah, the Troubadour had tables that came out from the stage in a long line. So we're all sitting literally at the feet of Jim Messina. Richard Meltzer, the famous R. Meltzer, was sitting opposite me looking very, very bored. And of course, the whole place is effusive and everything's going on. And these guys are, as you look down the row of the band, like, you know, almost in profile, because I was right next to the stage, all you could see were all these shiny white teeth and big grins from the band. And Meltzer at one point picked up his beer bottle and starts banging it on the table out of time with the song. And Messina just stared down at him while he's singing the harmonies, and the eyes just came back up to stare out of the back of the room, and he never looked down again. It was quite funny.
Is that, that's Poco we're talking about, I'm guessing.
I know, yeah, no, I'm right.
Who would that be?
Whoever's at the far end of the stage from Glenn Frey.
Because Messina, I don't think, played with the Eagles.
Messina wasn't. I mean, I have to say, the Eagles are not my favourite band.
So you're entitled, you're entitled to get the personnel wrong,
is it,
I think.
Randy, yeah. Meisner? Would it be Meisner?
That would be the band, yes. They all look the same, long-haired guys, bright teeth.
They were all the same, wearing double denim with long hair and kind of leather waistcoat.
And dusting of white powder under their nostrils.
No, they couldn't afford that at that point. That was
I bet they could.
I think the most interesting thing was watching British bands touring America. I saw Zeppelin on their second tour. That was May of 69. By summer of 71, I think they'd come through about six times through Los Angeles. The Faces, the same kind of thing. You'd go and see these guys, and you'd see them every 4 months, 5 months. Humble Pie was another one. They just toured incessantly.
Yeah, the great bitch from English fans at the time, those guys go to America and never come back. I mean, the number of times Led Zeppelin toured the UK was minuscule compared to the number of times they toured the States. And the Faces have actually lived in America from sort of 73 on, you know. It was quite extraordinary. We just never got to see those bands.
It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, I'm trying to add them up. The Faces I saw 1, 2, 3, 4 times in the space of about a year, year and a half. Similarly, Zeppelin. They must have come five times, six times easily. You'd be at somewhere like the Forum, and there would just be this announcement of Led Zeppelin, and every girl in the place would start screaming.
The new Beatlemania.
It was, definitely.
I mean, we could just jump forward very abruptly to this little paragraph from your interview with the Sex Pistols, because it is just the antithesis of all of that, John. Flared jeans were out, leather helped, all black was better. Folks in their late 20s, chopped and channeled teenagers, people who frequent sex, the King's Road Avon leather, rubber and bondage clothing shop, people sick of nostalgia, people wanting forward motion, people wanting rock and roll that is relevant to 1976. So what would my question be? when you first saw the Pistols, I mean, did you just instantly and instinctively feel this is just turning over the tables of everything that I've been writing about for, what would it be at that point?
Five years. Yeah, five years. Mm. Yeah, I've been I've been fed up with what was coming out for a good year, at least, really getting bored with it all. There was so much self-congratulation happening at the time. I just felt like there's got to be something new, and I went looking for it. And I was out there a lot, just going and seeing bands and following my instincts and asking people and following up what they had said was good. Mm. And it all just felt like continuations of the same thing. Pub rock really niggled at me. It was so ordinary, with the rare exception of Kilburn and the High Roads.
Yeah.
So I used to go and see them quite a bit and have very interesting talks with Ian Dury. And they were kind of conceptual, which I liked the idea of a lot. And so I was like, can you find something else like that that comes all fully packaged? And to me, the image was always has been, still is, really important about what a band looks like. It has to tell you, it can't be ordinary. Yeah. Guys in denim, I mean, Christ, I can walk down the street being that guy. I mean, I want something that I want God. I want him to come from Olympus and tell it all to me in the key of E for 2 hours and then go back home there in the gods. Then, there'd been quite a bit of stuff on the pistols in the various pages of the music press, and they were all kind of going on about, one, the fact that one, the name got me. I loved that name the second I saw it. The fact that everyone was so upset about them, that made it interesting. And people kept saying on about they can't play, which kind of intrigued me. I was like, okay, let's see what that's about. And so when I saw them, I was kind of predisposed in a way that they they better be good or I'd be very disappointed.
Now, I mean, it's really interesting is that the mythology is that the NME was the great paper that sort of backed punk, but actually Sounds and Melody Maker got there first, and you in particular got there first.
And well, Caroline Coon on the Maker.
Didn't you write one of the very first pieces on Pistols? Mm.
It is the first. It's the first interview.
Right.
Yes, first interview.
And that came about because when they played El Paradise Strip Club, which is where I saw them, that was a Sunday night. And so on Monday when I came into the office, the editor, who was Alan Lewis, asked me, said, so what were they like? And I was talking to him about it, and he just kept getting this very bemused look on his face and didn't say much. And then he said, I want you to do an interview with them. And I protested about that. And he said, do you realize how long you've been talking about it? I said, no. He goes, 15 minutes. You've been going on 15 minutes. Go out there and get a story. And that seems to be the effect they had on everybody the first time people saw them. They'd end up talking to, their wife or their friends or whatever forever about this weird new band. Nearly all of it down to John, of course. Well, yeah, without John, there's just three guys who can play reasonably, basically.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lydon is in full flow almost straight away. I hate shit. I hate hippies and what they stand for. I hate long hair. I hate pub bands. I want to change it so that there are rock bands like us. And you say, this is delivered at full tirade with a sneer to match the voice. He clocks my tortoise shell earring, the 5 weeks' laziness straggling across my cheeks and chin, and the sneer and the direct eye blitz never stops. I'm inadvertently thinking, gosh, I'm not a hippie now. That was a childhood error, and I never was one in the first place. Which is great. So you have a conversation with Lyon, you realise you're not a hippie anymore.
Well, the funny thing was, he came in late. We were at a pub called the Cambridge Arms on the Cambridge Circus.
Yeah.
Upstairs in this empty room, sticky carpet, the whole bit. And they were talking about John in the third person. He wasn't there. And when he came in, he came in with two girls, and they sat down about, 10 feet or more away in some chairs and kept on talking among themselves. And the band and McLaren, who was there, kept talking about him as though he wasn't there still, which I thought was, well, that was odd. And he was looking quite bored. And then I finally said, okay, they've been talking about you. What do you think? And that's when he lit up and went into that tirade. So up until then, he'd just kind of been very neutral. He hadn't done anything, hadn't said anything, hadn't made any kind of presence felt. And then it was just like a switch turned on. It was absolutely instant. And McLaren, I could see McLaren out of the corner of my eye, and he's kind of watching me, and he's watching John, and you can sort of see this look on his face, like, the Larry Pounds look, oh, my goodness, what have I got here? And at the same time, he's kind of looking at a lab experiment. You know?
That is really interesting. Yeah, because, I mean, if that was the first interview, that's the first time McLaren saw Rotten being interviewed. And
yeah, oh, absolutely.
Giving quote, you know.
Being John. I mean, it's one of those things, you know, more and more, especially from following them really closely for the rest of that year, you realize that people like John and someone like Mick Jagger say, and that kind of, you know, like serious presence, it just lifts a room because of who they are. That's just accident. You know, they come fully formed. You either got the guy in your group or you don't. You don't create those people. And that really struck through as he got better and better at being John Rotten.
Not only did you write about and document not just the Pistols, but a lot of the punk bands in that year, and you mentioned Caroline Coon also in the third piece we've got, which is you're looking back at that year of 76. But you also took these great photographs of the scene, which really do document what it must have felt like. I mean, did you feel that sort of by, should we say, like a mid-77, that the really kind of great moment had already sort of peaked and passed? Is it in many ways about 76 for you?
Well, 77 is really interesting, I think, in the sense that people took the next steps forward. It stopped being this kind of secret club, for both better and for worse. The idea, and, you know, and the idea of you don't need to know more than three chords. Here's a chord, here's another chord, here's a third, go start a band. The problem was, I think it started getting codified by the end of 77, you know, and this kind of year zero mentality that anything before 1977 or 76 was terrible, which was patently idiotic. Right. And then it turned into business. You know, the record companies came in, the managers came in. I remember very much seeing Miles Copeland with Stewart very early on, and that kind of Miles going to Stewart, this is the future, you better find yourself a punk band. Was he formed the Police. So it became business. It became about money. It became about, you know, doing all the things that everybody had ever done in terms of making records, go on tour, be famous. But I think that the spirit certainly carried on, and it carried on until we got to, you know, I think by the end of Duran Duran, say, early 80s, 83, 84, then it's, man, we're back to, you know, the ideas were carrying forward, but then they got neutered as well. And it just became business as usual again. Next generation of kids, great, throw them up the charts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Serendipitously, we're adding this week a retrospective piece about ITA. And I stumbled on this quote in it.
Hey, don't
this
knock
it. It's a piece by Kieran Tyler from 2002 for Ugly Things. You know Johan Kugelberg, don't you? I'm sure. Because, I mean, didn't he write the foreword to your Spirit of 76?
John Savage wrote the foreword, but it was Johan Kugelberg who kicked the whole thing off when he saw my photo.
So this is a piece from Johan's Ugly Things, and it's Andy Blade of ITA, who were all about 14 or 15.
15,
and he's
reminiscing.
He says, I rang up John Ingham from Sounds and persuaded him to come see us rehearse. We'd read his article about the Pistols and we were really keen. We liked the bit that said you don't have to play. I said we were a punk band. He came to see us with Rat Scabies, who said he knew a guy who played drums better than my brother. John said, my advice is get this guy in, speed all your... Or maybe it was Rat who said that. I'm not sure. Probably Rat saying, my advice, get this guy and speed all your songs up and then you'll be a proper punk band. The following week, it was in Sounds, so it was official. ITA were a punk band. I just love that.
It's all true. I can remember. In fact, I remember it very well. They're in a rehearsal room, usually in a basement, I'm sure. The drummer is all of 12 and a half years old. His name is Degenerate.
Of course.
And they did I'm 18 by Alice Cooper. And I looked at him and I said, how old are you? And he said, I'm 15. I said, then why are you singing about being 18? You don't know anything about it.
And they changed it to I'm 15.
I said, you should change it to your own age. And Andy took that and ran with it.
That is just brilliant. It's a shame they didn't I don't think they ever recorded I'm 15, but I'd like to have heard it, I must say. So tell us what happened, you know, in the wake of punk. I mean, you carried on writing, but your career took various twists and turns. I mean, you ended up as head of content at CompuServe here in the UK. So sketch out for us how you got from ETA to CompuServe.
Okay, so I'll do this as short, quickly as I can. 77, I started managing Generation X, which was cool. Idol. Did that for a year.
And, Sir William of Idol, or whatever it was.
Sir William of Idol. Yeah. And I won't mention him by name. They were basically unmanageable, you know, the two main guys. And there's probably a full football team of ex-managers for Billy, who, by the way, I will defend to the end for making some really great records in the 80s. Yeah, yeah. That stuff is amazing.
Yeah.
And holds up, really holds up. Anyway, that took a year out. I went to Los Angeles at the end of 77 to spend Christmas with my mother, and it was a mid-January day, and it was 25 degrees and clear sky, and I'm thinking, why am I in London where everything's cold and miserable and wet when I could be here? So I moved back to LA and got a job doing special effects for movies, and like pre-computer graphics. It was very early days of computer animation. And at the same time, picked up managing a punk group, LA punk group called The Weirdos.
Oh, they're
also unmanageable. I seem to have a talent for them.
Attracted like a moth to a flame.
Indeed. But the best thing that came out of it was I kept, you know, I had this day job doing this stuff. But then all these punk bands in LA started coming up to me and going, I don't really want to manage it, but I've got this, you know, I've got a record company putting a contract in front of me. Would you help me go through the contract and negotiate it? Or I'm going on a tour. Would you be tour manager and set up all the gigs and the dates and everything? So I started having these great sort of 1 or 2 month associations with bands, one of whom I'll also recommend, The Plugs, P-L-U-G-Z. Who were incredible. They were great. Two of them from Texas, Chicano, and then they'd have a bass player, whoever was, you know, they'd go through a variety of bass players across the years. But, you know, great singers, great songwriters, great players. And then I started a club called The Fake Club, which was based on people, you know, like Blitz here, where they'd hire a club for a night. Oh, that's another thing that came out of punk. There was a guy called Steve Harrington who kept bugging Generation X when we'd go out west. And he was from Wales, and he'd come and see any gig going. And then he asked us to drive him back up to London because he wanted to move to London from where he was. And the next thing I knew, he was this guy called Steve Strange. So I'd seen Steve at Blitz, and I thought, this is a cool idea. There's nothing happening in LA. So I started a club in a cocktail lounge in Hollywood twice a week. So we were the first person to break a lot of records coming out of New York, coming out of London. We were playing stuff nobody was playing. And at its peak, we'd have 1,000 people a night, $5 at the door, no guest list. It was up to the doorman to let you in. And famously told Britt Eklund she couldn't come in because she didn't have ID. So it was one of those things where you'd look around and you go, oh, there's Prince. Oh, that's Susan Sarandon. Oh, there's Richard Gere. It was very weird.
Wow.
It was very down market. There was nothing fancy about this place except that it was a 1950s cocktail club in Hollywood.
I did meet you once in LA at that time. I think it would have been 82 or 83.
82, yeah.
And I have a memory of you. You know, to me, was somewhere like the Hollywood Hills or Los Feliz or Silver Lake or somewhere like that. I remember you opening a door slightly furtively and wondering what I was doing there.
Trade inquiries around the back, please. Yeah, no. It was for people
Say
who
no
know,
more squad.
For people who know Los Angeles, it was at the very top of Gower Street. Above Franklin Avenue, I could
sense.
See the Capitol building from my front door. Art Garfunkel lived down at the other end of this little dead-end street about, like, 200 meters away. Yeah.
No wonder you missed London so much.
It was a very Hollywood – it was the best Hollywood fantasy because here I was living in what had been the maid's quarters of a huge mansion in Hollywood, looking over the entire basin. and just, you know, in a great time to be in LA. It was incredibly amazing creatively. There was a huge crossover between film directors like Jonathan Demme and actors. Used to see Jeff Goldblum at all sorts of concerts. The music people were interacting with all of that. The art crowd were interacting with all of that. And you'd have people like, you know, talking about people who came through town all the time, Talking Heads would come to LA and do 3 or 4 different gigs around the city. Yeah. I can remember, I mean, I would go and see them 3 times every time they came to LA. So yeah, it was just incredibly creative. And then it peaked with the Olympic Games. And at which point, and the other thing was all the Japanese creative people were coming into town at that point. So it was kind of this creative inundation. And so early 85, I got a letter from a guy called Morgan Fisher, who'd been in Mott the Hoople, and we were quite friendly. And he was in Tokyo, and he said, how would you like to come to this? The letter opened with the first sentence, how would you like to move to Tokyo and change your entire life? Okay, that sounds like an interesting idea.
That sounds a little par for the course for you.
Yeah, really. Well, I mean, I was in a position where, I mean, what do you do with a club that runs twice a week? It's got a shelf life. And gone on from that, there was a video bar down in West Hollywood. There was like a disc. It was a bar, and they had huge video screen, and they would play music videos rather than having a DJ playing records. So I did that for a year, running all the video stuff, and I was kind of making quite a bit of money. But it was one of those things of, what am I going to do next? It's not like a career path. And then this letter came. I thought, Tokyo. That sounds pretty cool. And a few letters later, in a plane flight, and I was living in Tokyo, working at an ad agency, and I did 6 years of that.
Wow!
And worked for and after about 3 years, I joined a record label called MIDI, which was an independent, very rare in Japan to have an independent. And their main artist was Ryuichi Sakamoto, right, and his wife Akiko Yano, and some other really amazing. I mean, you know, the Japanese artists who are creative and can write, they're phenomenal. So that's what I did for 3 years, was work with those guys. And Sakamoto is very interesting as well, in the sense that he was very famous. He was surrounded by people who would tell him yes. That was the standard answer. And he had a childhood friend who was his one guy he would count on to tell the truth. And that person drowned in a Christmas swimming accident. And so now he was cast adrift. There was nobody around him he would trust to be completely honest the whole time. And to watch all that take long-term effect was fascinating in one respect and quite sad in another, because he was really adrift in many ways while simultaneously creating some of the best music of his career. You know, he's doing Handmaid's Tale and Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. He did the album with, he did this album Neo Geo that had a lot of early sampling in it. The tracks with Iggy Pop, tracks with Brian. There's a track that's got Brian Wilson, Yusu Endur, and Robert Wyatt doing the backing vocals.
Presumably all in the vocal booth at the same time.
No, it's probably early, you know, digital recording technology, wow, passing the files around and whatever. But, you know, the fact that he got all those people to do it with him.
Yeah.
And the New York crowd, Erto Lindsay and those kind of people.
I mean, you've had this very prestigious career working for big businesses like CompuServe and O2. There can't be many people who saw Grand Funk Railroad at the Inglewood Forum who are working in that space. I mean, do you think you have a very different perspective on the way pop culture has kind of unfolded in, you know, since, you know, the mid-90s?
Ooh, that's a very open question. I've never really thought about it in those terms. I'm just kind of fascinated watching pop culture unroll and reveal itself on an ongoing basis. You know, I think a lot of modern pop music leaves me cold because of it's that digital approach. I find very deadening. There's no air. There's no space in any of it. From a Kraftwerk electronic viewpoint, a lot of it's fascinating. I mean, you know, and there are certain people like Mark Ronson and that who have an incredible ability to kind of put jigsaw puzzles together. And it's not aimed at me. It's aimed at some kid who's 15. You know, and so I appreciate the good stuff. I'm in awe of some of it. Gaga, I think, makes some amazing records. Ronson makes some amazing records.
Funny you should mention, did you say Lady Gaga?
Yeah, so...
Funny you should mention
it. I'm ignoring the prompt. I'll come back to it. what I do like seeing are the things that consistently carry on. There are lots of funny. You know, ego still runs rampant. Hooray! You know, what would life be without an unreasonable pop star?
Well, I mean, Lady Gaga is a fascinating pop star. As it happens, she's releasing her first album in, what is it, like 4 or 5 years. Tomorrow,
if you don't count the soundtrack
to A Star Is Born. So we're featuring her, John. We might as well just kind of skip through this since you're talking about modern pop. I happened to watch A Star Is Born earlier this week and emerge from it with a slightly more respect, I think, than I had. And I do think she's interesting, but John, rather like you, a lot of the huge sort of electro pop hits that she's had, they do leave me a bit cold. Maybe I am just too old to kind of hear them or appreciate them. I mean, do you think that she's done more interesting or different things from, say, like Madonna, who would be her kind of most obvious forebear?
Mm. Well, Bad Romance is just a great record, pure and simple.
Yeah.
And a phenomenal video to it as well.
Yes.
It doesn't come across to me that she's been as varied as Madonna. You know, Madonna had the whole sex period and the Justify Your Love, and then she did Vogue. And, you know, she's really been on Madonna's been on the tip of changes and helped make them popular. Gaga, not so much in the sense of bouncing across genres and picking up tips from here and there. I think A Star Is Born, the soundtrack, it's a great rock and roll record in a way. And in a way, it's a great rock and roll biopic. And with fictional people makes it easier.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to bring Jasper in here as someone who, as I occasionally point out, is slightly younger than us. And just ask what your sort of take on Lady Gaga is, Jasper.
Well, so those early singles were massive when I was still at school, and it was not really the kind of music that I was into. But listening back, I listened to a few of them this morning, and actually some of them, like Bad Romance, is great. And there are a couple of others where it is like that. That is a great pop sound. But I think that the key thing about Lady Gaga as compared to some other pop stars is that she does seem to really enjoy what she's doing. And you kind of say she moved from one genre to another, but she does seem to like flitting about and doing random things that she thinks will be fun, like a duet with Tony Bennett for The Lady Is a Tramp. And then doing
whole
this
album
film
with Tony Bennett, in fact.
Yeah, I mean, I think this kind of... other stuff going on as well. She's in a way a sort of very self-conscious art project.
Absolutely.
You know, and she's a magnificent thief. I mean, for example, everyone thinks she's the person who invented the meat dress, which she wasn't. She just stole that idea, but sort of then pervaded it out to a broader thing.
We've all worn meat dresses.
We've all worn meat dresses. In fact, I'm wearing one right now. But I saw this documentary, Gaga, 5'2", on Netflix a few weeks ago, and it was fairly depressing. She's relentlessly solipsistic. There are nice things about her in that she really genuinely seems to care for her fans, has a real... engagement with her fans. She's surrounded by people saying yes, exactly, John, what you were saying earlier about Sakamoto. You know, she's surrounded by people saying yes. She's in the studio with Mark Ronson, funnily enough, you know, doing whatever she was doing at the time. She was in the process of one of her image reinventions, stripping away all of the sort of glitz that she had been famous for and was suddenly going for a sort of completely reduced, almost punkish sort of look.
Mm, mm.
And eventually I just found the thing really boring. You know,
Isn't that partly just because it's, in some sense, it's something that you've seen before, whereas for people
quite possibly
of my generation who hadn't seen that before, those changes and her not really giving a fuck, and you know, there was all sorts of controversy.
Oh, but she gives
about,
such a fuck.
Does you know?
She gives such a fuck. She really relentlessly gives a fuck. I mean, she's so self-conscious about how people are perceiving her. That's all she talks about. You know,
yeah, but she's looking to push some boundaries by doing that, and she's looking to.
Yeah, but that's not the same as not giving a fuck.
I mean, it's sort of is and sort of isn't. She wants to. What you talk about loving her fans, she is genuinely, I think, keen to show people that they can do stuff even if they don't think they can. She wants
massive amounts of approval, is what she wants.
Were any of you surprised?
Make that different from any other pop star?
Well, exactly. Yeah. You want approval.
That's just a given for the pop idiom. Pop. Literally, it's in the name. You know.
Yeah.
I don't think that really sits as a criticism of a pop star.
I found it ultimately in this watching this documentary. I found it boring.
Was anyone surprised by A Star Is Born that she went back to? Well, she did something that was, in a sense, quite retrogressive. You know, it was quite mainstream in terms of its music. Certainly Bradley Cooper's figure was very, like, mainstream Americana rock. It seemed like an odd choice for someone who visually and kind of iconographically had been so radical, Lady Gaga. It's quite a straight role.
Yeah, I think so. I was also, I think she just was, she did well in that role, actually.
I agree. I was surprised by...
just how much I bought the character that she was playing for a very mainstream film, as you say. You know, she isn't there with blue hair and, you know, a conical bra and all that stuff. But there was something convincing about it, even though, you know, it's not my kind of film. Usually,
did you see it, John?
Oh, yeah. In the context of Gaga, her doing a mainstream role is groundbreaking. I'm serious.
I think it's quite smart.
I think the biggest problem with A Star Is Born that if you've seen an earlier version, you know how it ends. You know, you just sort of kind of waiting. Course. You're waiting for all the key points. You know, he comes to her award when he's drunk. He dies at the end, and she becomes Mrs. Norman Maine. Sorry to spoil it for everybody who hasn't seen it.
Does the male character does he die in all four of the films?
Yeah.
I've only seen the Garland one, and I've seen the Streisand and Christophe.
The Frederick March one, it's the blueprint. And in fact, it's based on a previous film that was not a musical.
One interesting thing about watching the documentary is, as a songwriter, she's actually a really ordinary piano-driven singer-songwriter of the old-school type. And it's the productions which make them sound radical. Because you take the production away, and she sits at the piano and sings these absolutely sort of by-rote singer-song, vaguely Carole King-ish songs.
There's one. Look, what I found in the movie was the one that struck me as most kind of Carole King-ish in a way. Mm-hmm. But it is good. It's a good ersatz Carole King.
Ersatz.
I'm alone in my house.
So, just quickly, we've got three pieces about the girl born Joanne Germanotta. If I pronounce it, I can't pronounce it.
Isn't it Germanotta?
Germanotta. All right, let me say that again. The girl born Joanna Germanotta. And the first of them is the redoubtable Caroline Sullivan, hailing these female solo artists who are all essentially working with synthesizers. And Caroline's seizing onto this as evidence that the male guitar band is dead. The future is electro, female, DIY, and very in your face. And she actually gets Lady Gaga on the phone from San Diego. And it was an interesting moment because, male guitar quartets had become pretty moribund at that point. And it was a breath of fresh air. It was an injection of something new, I think. And I don't suppose anyone saw Lady Gaga becoming the massive superstar at that point that she was going to be.
I was just
going
to add, the thing that always interested me about with Gaga is that she came over here and spent a long time in London, over a month or a couple of months, and she appeared on Jonathan Ross and so forth, and she had this incredibly ornate teacup with a saucer. and she carried it onto the set and sat down on the couch opposite Ross, and with the little finger up, would be sipping from it. And then 2 days later, she's filmed getting out of a taxi cab at somewhere like Buckingham Palace, and she's got the damn teacup in her hand. And for literally 3 weeks or so, there was not a picture or a video or an appearance at that. Teacup was not in a fan. I just thought, this is brilliant, because everybody starts talking about
funny.
The teacup.
Yeah,
it was absolutely
genius. Quite clever, and yeah, it's a fun thing to do. I think
that's the key in many. You know, it's the same with someone like Elvis Costello. You put on the glasses, you never take the glasses off, and everything becomes about the glasses. In her case, it all became about the teacup.
To go back to what you were saying earlier, Mark, about her being, you know, giving a fuck, but I think she is very self-aware in that sense. She does.
Oh, yeah.
She is pushing people's buttons intentionally.
Oh, yeah.
With stuff like the teacup or whatever she's doing at any given moment. She kind of knows what she's doing, and she's working it, that whole media circus. She's working it to her own advantage.
That's true enough,
in quite clever ways.
Yeah.
Just a brief name check for Kate Allen, who used to work for Oxback Pages. So the third and last of the Gaga pieces is a piece that Kate wrote for a publication called Planet Notion in 2014. And it's a really nice little piece about the risky business of Lady Gaga's performance art. In a sense, that's what she is, a performance artist. So, yeah, anyway.
It's worth pointing out that Kate Allen made the very rational decision to get out of Roxback Pages and become an entertainment lawyer.
Yeah, we may need to hire her at some point. Anyway, this is a shout out to Kate. We miss you. It's lovely to have some of your pieces on the site. She was a real pop princess too, wasn't she? She was School of Caroline Sullivan.
Very much.
Not
very
a lot
much.
Of time for male guitar bands. But we are going to go back to the sort of world of sort of dreary male musicians now, aren't we, Mark? Because we're going to talk about the week's audio interview, and it's going to take us back to the early 70s.
Yes, Martin Aston interviewing the great John Peel, legendary inverted commas DJ, in July 1989. And they're having, by the way, they're eating in a restaurant, so there's quite a lot of background noise. And also, every now and again, Peel's got a mouthful of food that he has to sort of struggle through to sort of get what he wants out.
It's just the authentic interview experience.
Well, yes. Absolutely. He talks about, in a way, the curious thing about this interview is I think Martin Aston thought of John Peel in a way that John Peel doesn't think of himself. So there's a lot of sort of like negotiating singers, you know, is he a figurehead? Is he this? Is he that? And John's always saying, no, I'm a fan. You know, I like stuff because I like it. There's no agenda behind it. There's no attempt at sort of creating a culture or anything like that. He has no intellectual response to pop at all. You know, it's just, does he like this record or doesn't he like this record? And he's going through a time when this interview took place where the stuff he was liking was getting noisier and noisier and noisier.
One of the things he had to contend with a little bit was that once he'd become the guy who played, you know, every scratchy, abrasive new indie single that was coming out, some people remembered that back in, you know, 1971, he was sort of playing Gong and Supertramp.
Absolutely.
I mean, I remember him playing Peter Frampton's Show Me the Way, you know, and in a sense, he had to...
I'm not sure he went that far.
He did. He played Show Me the Way.
Okay.
Absolutely. My hand on my heart. And I mean, the first of the clips, in a sense, kind of, he talks about playing crap, doesn't he? So maybe we should hear that, and it would kind of orient.
And also he talks about his label Dandelion, and Aston challenges him, and he actually vigorously defends his signing choices from 1971.
If you look back through the history of the programmes, I've played so much crap. But in amongst the crap, there's been some real gems as well.
Who would you call crap? I mean, what areas?
Well, I think you only see that like a decade or so later.
So,
but a lot of singer-songwritery kind of things that I played in the beginning of the 70s. People obviously weren't around at the time. I can't imagine what the 70s, early 70s were like.
Do you mean they're like Philip Goodhand Tate or...
Oh, no, Philip Goodhand Tate.
Well, or...
no, Philip Goodhand Tate was good in the Stormersville Shakers days. But it's perhaps crap's too strong a word, but it's a lot of stuff which now, I mean, I blush prettily to the roots of my hair when I hear these, when I hear some of these things.
Well, surely, yeah, I'm sure when people mention the label Dandelion, you missed similarly.
Oh, not at all. There were some things on Dandelion that I'm quite proud of. I mean, there's Stack Waddy, I thought were wonderful then, and still think it's wonderful. Do you remember Stack Waddy?
I love that. Classic Peel. I would blush prettily to the roots of my hair. Classic Peel. John,
yeah.
tell us about John Peel and what your first awareness of this amazing underground DJ was.
Back in LA, I'd met through science fiction fandom, I'd met Greg Shaw, who started what we all agree is the first rock and roll magazine, Mojo Navigator Rock and Roll News, which was contemporary to Crawdaddy. And I used to, Greg lived in San Francisco, so I would get a bunch of records to trade in, fly up to San Francisco, stay with Greg, and we would go to Village Music, I think it was called, in Mill Valley, and I would sell all my records to pay for the trip. And in one of those, he said, I found this new magazine called Zigzag. And so we started reading Zig, looking through it. And in that was John Peel talking about, I think, Dandelion Records or possibly Tyrannosaurus Rex. Yes. That was my first encounter with John. And I know what it was. He was talking about Neil Young. And he proposed this theory that musicians really only grew into their full strengths when they made their third album. Because by then they knew how to make a record, and they were forced to write the songs to match that. They had the experience by then that forced is probably the wrong word, but they grew into their the peak of their creative strengths.
Right.
So that was John, and then when I came to London at the time, he was writing a column in Sounds every week, and he also wrote in Punch. He was writing a regular column, and he's such a great writer. He was very funny. And quite droll. And so I that was where I really picked up on kind of interacting with John Peel as we know him. And I mean, we met quite a few times over the years, and, you know, social situations, shared a drink and all the rest of it. And it was, even then, it was kind of like he was the guy that would play stuff that no one else would play, or that you didn't hear anywhere else. I can remember that. You know, he played a South African record, the Mohatella Queens, in 1975.
Yeah.
And it was like, go on, admit you like it. That was his comment. I thought, that's such a great comment.
I mean, for any younger or any listeners who just don't really know how important Peel was, I think, you know, Mark, you know, you and I could both say that Peel was essential. It was mandatory listening. I mean, I discovered so many things. You know, this little transistor radio, probably started listening to him in about 73, I think. And just every night I would go to bed. He had the show on Radio 1. I think it was a 10 o'clock start. And I would just, it would be glued to this. And I would write down what he was playing. I mean, sure. And that, I think... Thousands of people could say the same thing.
Yes, you and many, many people. I have to say, not myself. I sort of never really got into John Peel for some reason. I wasn't really a great radio listener. I know it sounds kind of strange, but I wasn't one of those people who kind of like had their ear. And when I was younger, I was listening, a lot younger, I was like 11, 12, I'd be listening to Radio Luxembourg on my transistor radio when, you know.
Yes.
But I sort of hated the sound of the transistor radio. I sort of hated DJs. I hated the bullshit talk between the records. And I sort of stopped listening to the radio. So Peel sort of passed me by. I was totally unaware of his transition when he'd kind of discovered punk and stopped playing Gentle Giant and started playing the Sex Pistols. You know, all of this stuff really passed me by. But I've subsequently, I'm well aware of his importance. I mean, I think he's an incredibly important person.
Shall we hear the second clip? Because Martin talks to him about being this kind of, having become, or this role of being this sort of figurehead of kind of indie alternative music has been slightly imposed on him.
Which he slightly rejects.
It's quite funny.
John Peel basically is the figurehead for what is known as alternative music or independent music.
It's not a role that I've sought, but
it's been foisted on you because you've carried, I mean, you know, you've been going longer than any other DJ on Radio 1, therefore you are perceived as a champion.
Well, yeah, it used to be possible to get to buy a publication in Germany where I also did programmes. There was something before, something like 132 things to do rather than listen to the rock dictator John Peel.
He's always self-deprecating. That was one of his charms, although you did wonder sometimes whether it was a little bit manufactured.
Well, like his accent. He went to Shrewsbury, I mean, and yet he kind of speaks in this kind of broad scouse, which is, it has to be said, utter bullshit.
Well,
it's
affectation. I remember doing a profile on him and talking to John Walters, who is his producer, and he told us that this is the archetypal John Peel story. Peel had been, someone had bought him a first-class train ticket to go up to Liverpool or wherever it was in the north, and he looked at it rather sort of wistfully and said, isn't there any way I could get an economy or third class ticket, please? You know, I mean, he couldn't bear the idea of being in first class, you know.
Yes, the Salopian John Peel.
So, I mean, John, so you knew him a little bit. You met him a few times. I mean, you know, can you assess, do you know, just his role in, I suppose we would say, the kind of punk, post-punk years, right through into the 80s. He would play anything. He'd play hip-hop, he'd play industrial music, he'd play death metal. He really would play anything that just kind of amused him or intrigued him.
That was the great sort of grace of him, was that he would play everything and anything. But I felt frequently, as I would listen to a lot of these less than spectacular records, was, what does he really like? You know, it got to the point where I lost track of what his taste was, which I think is really important in a DJ who has a lot of influence and power. You know, once you understand what they think is good and what their own tastes are, then you can start to make assumptions around your feelings and your taste. And because he was just so broad, as he got more and more into just playing, it always felt to me that, like, he got to a point where he would play anything and he made no value judgments at all. And at that point, I found it really hard to start wondering what the things of value were that he was playing.
I guess it's hard if someone isn't committed to what they're playing you, hard to see why you should be committed to listening to them playing it to you.
Yeah. I used to listen to him on the car radio driving home. And so, and that was where I kind of started thinking that idea that, well, why should I listen to this guy? Because it's just, you know, I don't like most of what I'm hearing. Although, you know, you might want to persevere if you think this, if you're educated from the DJ's perspective as to why it's got value.
I think if you saw a list of bands who'd played sessions for John Peel, yes, there'd be some standout names, but there'd also be probably a huge number which you have no memory of whatsoever, because that was the only thing they did. They sent a tape to John Peel, he put them into the Maida Vale studios, did a session, and that was it, because they were of little value. They were no good.
I mean, my feeling was that but whenever I wrote this profile of him, which would have been about just as we went into the 21st century, and he was doing that Home Truths show on Radio 4, there was a sense that many people just listened to John Peel's show, not really for the music, but just for John Peel. Mm-hmm. There was something comforting and almost avuncular about Peel. And people just wanted to have him kind of, you know, talking away in the background in between in between like dub reggae records and Napalm Death records.
Anyway, it's a good interview. It's really worth listening. He does good interviews, unsurprisingly. You know, the guy can talk.
Weird. The radio broadcaster
exactly.
can talk.
Pretty astounding.
Well, so great, and we'll hear a clip right at the end where he's just talking about his, you know, continued worship of musicians, essentially. Yeah. And that's all I am as a fan. So, Mark, tell us about some of your highlights of the week.
Yeah, well, the first one's a real highlight. It's what's almost certainly the very last interview that Nat King Cole ever did with Ivor Davis for the Daily Express in 1965. Very sad. And Nat says, "Greetings to the outside world. I was just contemplating it down there, and I can't wait to rejoin. I will in a few more weeks." Now, he's in hospital. He's just had a lung removed. What he and Ivor Davis didn't know, but which Nat Cole's wife and doctor knew, was that he was dying. In fact, he died within about 4 days of the interview taking place.
Oh, my God.
So that's really something.
Unforgettable. That's what you are.
Moving on to 67, Penny Valentine's interviewing all but one of the people who are participating in the Walker Brothers tour, which includes Jimi Hendrix Experience and Engelbert Humperdinck, among others. And Jimi Hendrix is talking. He says, "I'm a bit worried about the type of people who are going to see the tour. If they come to see the Walker Brothers, then they're not going to want us," which I suspect was pretty true. And next one's fantastic. Philip Elwood. Now, John, this is interesting because Philip Elwood wrote for the San Francisco Examiner. And we got him on board recently. He's dead, but via his sons. And he saw a number of things you saw. He saw the Aretha Franklin 71 West Fillmore West show. He also saw the Winterland Sex Pistols last ever show.
I was there at that one too.
Yeah, indeed. And he sees Miles Davis supporting the Grateful Dead. Now, this is really quite a significant show. There's a lot of people talk about it. It was the very first time Miles played in a rock and roll ballroom to basically a rock crowd that Bill Graham put him on. Philip Elwood just loves it. He says, "There were fragments of some of Davis's recent recorded material in the marvellous montage last night. But one doesn't say, what's the name of that tune when listening to Miles? There's too much to hear as it is." He loves them. He's actually quite a fan of the Deads, but he says half the audience, probably including him, walked out after Miles' set. The Dead, I know, were mortified that Miles was supporting them because they all worshipped
him. Absolutely.
And Jerry Garcia became quite a good friend of Miles Davis subsequently. And the only rock band Miles Davis has any time for in his autobiography is the Grateful Dead.
Well, it's worth remembering Phil Lesh, the bass player, went to school with Philip Glass. I mean, that's the level of education he's got. And Jerry Garcia was really well known in that whole Bay Area as a bluegrass player and a folk musician. I mean, they came into the band with incredible background and credentials.
Yeah, I've got to be honest, I'm a bit of a deadhead. I mean, everything they did from 68 to 72, I kind of love.
Yeah.
And I love the live stuff particularly. But anyway, I'm really glad to have got that thing in because it's talked about quite a lot still as this sort of quite kind of pivotal moment.
Yeah.
Moving on, again, Philip Elwood, 76, he interviews Cab Calloway. Now, I just love this to have an interview with Cab. To have Cab Calloway on the site, you know.
That's great. Super.
And Calloway says, "That Reefer Man song was a typical midnight show thing. I think kids know it now because it's part of the Betty Boop cartoon soundtrack." He says, "In 47, I went from being a guy whose gross was $200,000 a year to someone who couldn't get a booking." And that's absolutely spot on. The end of the big bands was basically then. And suddenly bebop came in, the big bands went out, guys like whom couldn't get arrested. Very pleased to get this.
"Man, is that the Reefer Man?
That's the Reefer Man.
I believe he's losing his mind.
I think he's lost his mind."
Blues and Soul, 1984. David Nathan interviewing Maurice White of Earth, Wind and Fire. Well, sort of ex of Earth, Wind and Fire, because they had gone into sort of abeyance at this point. And the reasons were, essentially, they weren't doing as well as they had been. But these things are relative. So Marie says, "When Powerlight did just 900,000, we were concerned. It was a letdown. And to be honest, we felt a little rejected and a little deflated."
Oh.
900,000 records.
Rejected.
Rejected.
outright rejection. 900,000 records sold.
And lastly, Stephen Dalton talking to the Aphex Twin, Enemy 96.
Ah.
And it's just, he gives great interview, always. Barney, remind me of his his real name?
Richard James. I read this interview, actually.
Richard D. James.
Richard D. James, yeah. I'm a huge Aphex fan.
Oh, yeah.
He's a sort of acceptable, berserk, techno genius for older people, I think. But he is genuinely kind of nutty and a fascinating character. And I really like this interview. Actually, he comes over as quite accommodating and friendly in this interview. In some, he's sort of willfully difficult.
He can be pretty standoffish in interviews.
And he's not in this one.
I mean, he's very curious because he's very dismissive of the culture within which he's working. I haven't got a quote in front of me to say this, but there's this notion that all the other people working, you know, he's just not interested. He's got a very purist interest in sound.
Yes.
Almost for its own sake.
Well, the Paul quote that we're going to put on the homepage, he says, everyone tries really hard in techno and never gets anywhere. They're the most insecure section of music makers out there. another idea of the legions of insecure techno musicians.
I mean, I find it interesting that he's one of the few people working in that territory who you know of, you know, because it's such a sort of personality-free zone, so much of that sort of dance music.
He is a real personality, for sure.
Definitely.
Are you aware of Richard James's oeuvre, John?
Early Aphex Twin, yes.
Yeah.
And then around the time he did, what was it called, something sticker?
Window Licker.
That's where we parted company.
I thought Window Licker is probably the greatest thing he ever did. It's absolutely magnificent. But I did love the selected ambient audio works, I thought were pretty great. I mean, it's probably where I came.
And they still stand up, actually, for something that for electronic music recorded in the late 80s, early 90s. Yeah. The sound of them is just still, like, really present and really there.
And some of it's so beautiful, I think, you know. Yeah. There's really abrasive, juddering, insane stuff that he does, of course. But there are these really beautiful, almost kind of wistful things.
It's always set off against each other as well. It'll go from one to the other in seconds, and suddenly you're just being bashed about the face by these glitchy kind of...
Yeah,
I think it's really exciting.
He says this one thing, he says, I like to make music that sounds like you're tripping and reminds you of being off your face on acid, because I love that mood. But you can't make music when you're in that state. Well, tell that to Grateful Dead.
Clearly he's trying.
Tell that to Ministry.
that's my lot. What do you guys got?
Well, Jasper, I'm going to hand straight over to you in the interests of getting...
I'll just mention a couple of things quickly just because I added some articles about bands I really like, basically. Phoenix, an interview in 2000, relatively early interview, Lisa Verrico chats to a French band. The stand first is Phoenix are French and funky and like some very uncool records indeed. And I think that speaks to something that we kind of talked about previously with musicians of that, like Daft Punk as well, liking a bunch of records like Supertramp and kind of being very much looking backwards to a sound that they then combined with the new electronic sounds. That's an interesting short interview. We listened mainly to hip-hop when we were making the album, says Darcy. Traditionally, rock bands don't bother much about sound. In house and hip-hop, the production is part of the songwriting process. When we start a track, we think as much about how it will sound as what chords we will play.
Yep.
Then he claims, that's why we're not retro. Anyone who says we are is wrong. So, you know...
I really like the first Phoenix album. I have to say, I like that first album, United. There's a great song that really kind of almost does tie in with that idea of them being proto-yacht rock, which is, I think it was called Too Young, was the first single from it. It's like kind of LA, I'd call it yacht pop more than yacht rock.
Yeah.
They were great. I thought they were really interesting.
I think so too. And I like you have a soft spot for that kind of yachtish, kind of shiny production. Moving on to 2001, a live review of Ali Farka Touré. Adam Sweeting goes to see him in London. And it's a rather sort of sweet thing because, you know, he seems to enjoy himself on stage. But, quote, it has become increasingly difficult to prize Malian guitarist Ali Farka Touré away from the rural life in his home village of Niafunke. Music is very important to me, but my profession is agriculture, who spends most of his time irrigating chunks of the Sahara Desert. So it's sort of an interesting look at, you know, him as musician versus him as, you know, agriculturalist. but he gives a good gig, and I really like some of his music. It's just a nice sound, kind of bluesy.
I'm sure I would admire him as much as a farmer as a musician, I think. But I do love this record. I mean, yeah. You know, the record he did with Ry Cooda was pretty special, I think. You know?
Yeah, I agree. 2005, Daft Punk, the aforementioned, a review of Human After All. And it's a much maligned album, Human After All, their sort of third album, where it's not got the kind of groundbreaking electro sound that Homework did, and it's not got this shiny disco thing that Discovery did. But actually, Stephen Dalton reviewing it in the Times, it's just a sort of short capsule review, but he does get some stuff that a lot of people didn't get. That he says, there is less conceptual baggage here than on Discovery, but Human After All is still dominated by glistening paeans to the joys of machinery, from the thumping video arcade riffs of Robot Rock to the helium-voiced vocoder rap of Technologic. It is shamelessly synthetic, but magnifique too. I think actually it's a better record than most critics gave it credit for at the time, and most listeners sort of skip over it. You go straight from Discovery to Random Access Memories. But actually, where it comes most into its own is on the live album, Alive 2007, when it's combined with other stuff. There are some really great ideas in there, at least. So I thought it was nice to get a review of that album in.
Daft Punk fan, John?
Yeah, not following them particularly, but very much like what I heard. And of course, you know, the whole Let's Get Lucky in that album is just extraordinary.
I agree.
Record at the right time of the year.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then lastly, just because it's a complete left field of everything else.
We're running out of time, Kat.
Yeah,
there's me self-censoring.
I really can't resist mentioning this piece I've added about George Russell and his Lydian chromatic concept of tonal organisation.
Thank God you got that in, Justin. This episode would have been much poorer for the lack of that.
But I mean, it's really important stuff, actually. I mean, the history of modal jazz wouldn't be the same without George Russell and the Lydian chromatic concept of tonal organisation. So, you know, I think it's...
just trips off the tongue.
Or James Brown, if you agree with Jerry Wexler.
Anyway, I mean, I won't... the mood is such that I shan't go into it.
Oh, God, but, get chromatic on
it. It's just the complete remastered recordings reviewed by Rob Young in The Wire in 2011. And if you like Miles Davis, John Coltrane, etc., but you don't know George Russell, there's a sort of gap in that. And I don't think he's really mentioned enough because people always know about
what generation, you know, is George Russell, Jasper? Can you just put that in context for us?
Born 1923, so slightly older, same generation as like
Gil Evans,
Charlie Parker,
people like that. Yeah. Parker, yeah.
So that sort of early bebop. But I think he gave up drumming after he heard Max Roach playing, which I think is sort of fair enough thing to do. Anyway, George Russell,
great,
and a review of just of his complete recorded works as a re-release in The Wire.
Wonderful. Well, we probably should finish up now, John. I mean, it's just been a delight having you on the show. You've had an extraordinary life, and you've talked brilliantly about some points along the way. Yeah, it's just an honour to have you on RBP, and lovely to have you in the virtual cupboard. As I said, come back and see us again soon, etc. And I think, Mark, you're gonna take us out with the last Peel clip.
Yeah, I mean, this is we talked about it earlier, but it's basically about how he's always been primarily a fan and just loved musicians and is still in awe of what they do. That's essentially it. So we'll see you next week. Have we got a guest next week, Brian?
Well, as things stand, we have Danny Baker coming into the cupboard next week. I'll believe that when I see his face on my computer screen. he has said he will join us next week. So
that'd be brilliant.
I'm looking forward to that and hope it happens. But John, thanks so much again for coming in. Any parting words for our vast listenership?
Well, I was listening to, and you were just, you know, name-checking various pieces. I'll leave you with a book to recommend called The Chitlin Circuit by Preston Lauterbach, which is a really well-written and researched history of literally the Chitlin Circuit in the 20th century and the Afro-American musician experience.
Sounds
the
great.
Key points being, you will find out the discovery of Al Green, and how they got him to Memphis and recording, and the history of James Brown as to why he's the hardest working man in show business and why they're called the Famous Flames. And I'll leave you with that.
Fantastic.
That's
great. Super.
Well,
thank you.
Yeah. Great to have you on, John, as Barney said. We'll see all of our listeners will hear us next week.
Hopefully,
thank
Danny
you for
Baker. Until
me.
Then, thanks for joining us.
Cheers. Thank
thanks,
you, very
John.
Much
bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Marquis Smith walked in here now and sat down at this table. I should be awestruck. I mean, genuinely, I said, it sounds like you're saying these things for affect, you know, because they look good in print.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so. I should be just probably rendered speechless. You know, I mean, and I quite like that in myself, in a way, because I like still being, I suppose, naive in a way. I like being a fan. You know, I think if I stop being a fan, I mean, Walters always says in interviews and so on that the programme would be in real problems if I ever reached puberty, which is it's always quite a clever thing to say. But it's not a million miles from the truth, really. I mean, it's case like in a way, it's a case of sort of arrested development, if you like. But I like the idea of still being excited by it.
That was John Peel in conversation with Martin Aston in 1989, concluding this week's Rock's Back Pages podcast. Many thanks to special guest John Ingham. Stay at home and buy his book, Spirit of 76. The hosts were Barney Hoskins and Mark Pringle, and it was co-hosted and produced by Jasper Murison Bowie. The Rock's Back Pages podcast is part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. You can find thousands of articles, as well as hundreds of full-length audio interviews, at rocksbackpages.com.
With the Baker's Plus card, it's easy to get lower than low prices. For the win! Earn fuel points on every purchase and save up to $1 a gallon at the pump. The Baker's Plus card. All you do is win. Big, big savings. Sign up now at bakersplus.com and start saving. Baker's. Fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on your favorites with the Buy 5 or More Save $1 Each sale. Simply buy 5 or more participating items and save $1 each with your card. Baker's. Fresh for everyone.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com. Code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.